Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WVUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Here's Queens Congressman Anthony Weiner yesterday speaking as another plane exploded, speaking for all New Yorkers. He said, It couldn't have happened at a worse place. This is like the aftershock of an earthquake. Just when you're getting comfortable, another plane falls out of the sky. It's been a brutal season for the Big Apple and the emotions of New Yorkers. Tonight, the New York state of mind. But first, the Bush-Putin summit began in Washington today. The anti-ballistic missile treaty and war in Afghanistan are expected to be the focus of conversation during the summit, which will continue at the Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, on Wednesday and Thursday. Francine Kiefer is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in their Washington bureau. I asked her about the major developments of this first day of the summit.
There were two themes that dominated the meetings today, at least that came out in their joint press conference with us. One was the war in Afghanistan and on terrorism, of course, and the other one was kind of a relic from the Cold War, nuclear missiles, how many we should have, and so on. And on that front, President Bush announced that he would be happy to reduce, or that he planned to reduce over the next decade, our nuclear missiles by over two-thirds, from about 7,000 down to, he gave a range of 1,700 to 2,200 missiles over the next decade.
And did Putin make a counteroffer then?
He did not counteroffer, but he said they would try to meet that. His words exactly were he would try to respond in kind. But a point that he brought out was he would like to see those kinds of reductions, you know, in an agreement, in a form of a treaty. And President Bush really is not interested in that.
Bush is more interested in taking treaties apart on the nuclear front. Was there discussion of the ABM treaty and the missile shield?
Yes, there was quite a bit of discussion about that. It was the one area where there was just firm disagreement between the two sides. The president said he'd like to still go ahead with the missile shield defense and that we don't need the treaty that would prevent us from doing that anymore. And Putin said his position is unchanged on that, and they both agreed they were going to have to continue to talk about that in Crawford over the next 2 days.
Why wouldn't President Bush be prepared to put the number of missiles he's willing to cut into a document?
That it's going to get bogged down in negotiations. He said today he remembered TV images from the 1980s of seeing negotiators in big rooms sitting across from each other haggling and talking and talking and talking about how they were going to verify and how many it was going to be. And he just doesn't want to get bogged down in all that. He says the nature of our relationship has changed. We're friendly now. We have goals in common. We can trust each other. And I tell you I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this.
Is there any precedent for these nations doing something of such magnitude on the basis of a handshake and a promise?
There isn't any precedent. I mean, that's why this is such uncharted territory. And I'm sure that's why the Russians are so nervous about this. Putin said today he'd like something that shows that you can verify what the U.S. is doing and that you control what the U.S. is doing. He wants to be able to watch and see that it's really happening. You can understand why Putin would want this, because today Bush said, for instance, he's going to reduce the missiles that are operationally deployed. He said nothing about destroying these missiles.
I see. So just flip the off switch for a while, but not actually destroy them would be possible.
Yeah, he said nothing about destroying, and I'm sure those are the kinds of questions that Putin has, and that's why he would like to nail some of these things down.
How about on the war in Afghanistan? What was Putin's language and his body language?
You know what I thought was so interesting about that was in this way you really could see us moving beyond the Cold War. Both he and the president talked about not imposing an outside solution on Kabul and the government, very much supporting a UN-driven government that represents a broad selection of the tribes in Afghanistan, that is diverse, that respects human rights. And to hear Putin going along with all of this and specifically say, we don't want a solution from the outside, was very interesting. And they were in broad agreement as to what comes next.
The issue of Chechnya played relatively large in George Bush's political campaign, but it's been off the table at this summit. When, if ever, will Chechnya be brought back onto the table now that Russia is our ally in the war on terrorism?
Right. Well, what's interesting is that President Bush mentioned Chechnya in passing today, and he felt that Russia was making progress on human rights, and for that reason, he ventured into an area that is another Cold War relic, which was sanctions that we had placed on the then Soviet Union. Basically, this said, we're punishing you, Soviet Union, because you're not letting Jews emigrate and you're not treating minorities correctly, and so we're not going to have normal trade relations with you. Well, today the president said Russia has made significant progress on minorities and human rights, and for that reason the president is going to push in Congress that this old link between emigration, human rights, and trade, that be done away with so that Russia can step up to normal trade relations and move toward joining the World Trade Organization.
Was this seen as friendly payback for Russia's support in the anti-terror coalition?
Well, I don't know if it's, payback directly. You never know exactly why these things happen, but certainly it's something that the Russians want, and it is a way for the United States to express some gratitude for the real help that Russia is giving us in dealing with the war on terrorism.
The two leaders are heading off soon to President Bush's ranch in Texas. They have a famously collegial soulmate relationship, as George Bush said, he looked into his eyes. But the administration is playing down expectations overall for this summit. Why is that?
Well, they're trying to move that ball along that's called the missile defense shield. The president wants that, and there just isn't any agreement about that. And they're saying, we're going to talk about it in Crawford, but, don't expect anything to happen on that yet. So instead, this part two of the summit in Crawford kind of gets billed as more bonding between the two presidents. And I know that sounds kind of funny. They're going to be having a chuck wagon dinner and some cowboy entertainment under the stars, or I don't know if it's stars or late afternoon, but anyway, mm-hmm. They will be meeting on the ranch, and the president will show them around his ranch and so on. But, they're emphasizing that part of this now because they're not likely to get an agreement on the missile shield defense, even though they still will be talking about it.
Francine Kiefer is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke to her earlier from Washington. New York is being tested again. The fragile emotional coalition that New Yorkers had built for themselves since the terrorist attack on the Twin Towers is being tested again. There are no survivors of Flight 587, but even if you didn't know anybody on the American Airlines Airbus, if you're a New Yorker, you are a survivor. The fear of another catastrophe, a fresh round of grieving, the betrayal of another beautiful day has become the reality of life in the city. How is this great city coping or losing it? And what does it matter now for all Americans? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from New York is writer Dorothy Samuels. She's a longtime member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the recent novel, Filthy Rich. Welcome, Dorothy Samuels.
Good evening.
Hi, thanks for being with us. With us in the studio is tonight's guest analyst, Robert Reich. He was Secretary of Labor in the first Clinton administration and is now Professor of Social and Economic Policy at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hello, Robert Reich.
Good evening, Tom.
Dorothy Samuels, it's back. How bad is it in New York? How are New Yorkers taking this, all this shock and sadness? Is there a sense of living in some kind of cosmic bullseye?
This week, as New Yorkers pass each other, it's almost like we throw up our heads at each other and nod our heads, and we sort of all know what we mean. We all know what we mean, which is this is what's next, and how could this happen, and how did we get to a point where we're all relieved to learn that this probably wasn't a terrorist act, but rather, engines falling off an airplane. Which is quite a commentary. Yeah. On the other hand, I'll tell you, we're coping. I don't see people running away, and I don't see many people abandoning ship. What I do hear a lot of is people not only, wondering, well, now what, but also now what for a city that depends a lot on tourism to have this come right after the Twin Towers, And it just seemed just as we were, you know, gaining our sea legs again.
Right. Well, you know, part of how the rest of the country thinks about New York maybe depends on how New Yorkers think about New York. And Dorothy Samuels, you're such a great observer. And we know that New York is endlessly nuanced. It's a big, infinitely complex mind and heart there. Take us inside. Give us some examples of how New Yorkers are responding, of the conversations you're having with your friends. Presumably, people aren't numb anymore. They're coming out, and New Yorkers do talk.
Well, you know, I think of there's a lot of fear about what the fiscal crisis is going to mean. And so the airplane struck, I think, a lot of people, not just as this enormous tragedy and scary event that, again, recalls September 11th. Mm-hmm. But also reminds us of the depth of our financial problems and that we are, you know, heading to a terribly black period where, you know, the Financial Control Board, I think the same day, you know, the story's in on the crash, we have a front page story about the Financial Control Board is going to be coming back to New York City, which is something we haven't seen.
Shades of the old bad days.
Oh, boy. And, you know, a colleague of mine, I think it was yesterday, was telling a story of visiting Saks Fifth Avenue at Fifth Avenue and 50th Street, you know, the flagship stores.
Yeah.
And he arrives at lunch hour. The place is empty. And he gets greeted, you know, like he's some sort of chic.
Because he's there at all.
Oh, boy. You know, he says he gets greeted by a manager who is, like, very polite and escorts him personally to the cause. All he wants is a little bottle of hand cream to give as a gift and to spend about $20. And he gets basically personally escorted, and then he encounters three different salespeople who are foisting their card on and begging him to call if he needs anything else. And he says he leaves. He felt so guilty, he ended up buying two bottles, larger size than he planned. And his bag was absolutely filled to the brim with samples. With
please, everybody please have another.
Please come back. Please come back.
And so this, Dorothy Samuels, in the wake of such a gilded decade in New York.
Oh, absolutely. This is, you know, people used to go to Saks and spend their small change. And the place was jammed. You thought they were giving stuff away. And the atmosphere is people are feeling very, very unsure about their own finances, about their jobs, about, you know, and it's on so many levels. It's the international news, the frightening local news, you know, just your physical safety, and then your economic security. And you know, do you take, you know, people are going through choices right now. I don't hear of a lot of people moving again, but I hear of a lot of people going through the anguish of, do I take the subway? Am I safe from anthrax on the subway? Mm-hmm. Are they testing for biological stuff if I go down there? And what is the MTA doing to protect me? On the other hand, you know, can I get a cab because there are certain street closings because they're still moving debris from the Trade Center, or there are certain other accidents, and we've done a lot of closings, and certain vehicles are being checked. So you're doing this calculus every day about your personal safety, just about getting to work, and also about closings and things that are a constant reminder. But on top of that, we also have the economic overlay of you know, of the reality that affects all of us personally about our jobs and about, you know, the city ourselves and whether this place is going to be livable. The kind of cuts we're talking about in New York, it's not just you get a financial control board, which essentially means the state comes in, the state city commission comes in and oversees the city's finances. Mm-hmm. What it means this time, it's not that the city necessarily was irresponsible about its spending in the Giuliani years as it was in the years prior to the original control board. The deal is that suddenly, you know, there is no money for basics such that if we tried to pay for it this year just in current expenses, we would have to do – if we had tried to balance our budget, we would have to cut just so many basic services, this place would probably not be livable.
Dorothy Samuels, we're joined by Robert Reich. I want to bring him in just before we take a quick break. Robert Reich, New York's taken a heck of a pop to the chops. It's a big, brassy city, but could any city take this – these blows and keep on ticking?
Well, if any city can, it's New York. Indomitable, aggressive, optimistic, tough, proud. You know, America looks at New York a little bit, Tom, like the rest of the world looks at America in terms of envy and fear and wonderment and pity. The city took probably the biggest knock that any city could ever possibly take, and yet New Yorkers that I know, every time I visit, I've been there about three or four times since September 11th, there is a determination there not to let this affect them.
We're going to come right back and really dive into the New York state of mind. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What does it matter now for all Americans how New York fares, how New York's psychology unfolds? Join us, or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're taking a look at the New York state of mind tonight. The city has been through an unbelievable series of trials this fall, right up until yesterday morning when we saw yet another column of smoke rising up on a beautiful blue sky day over New York City. We're joined by Dorothy Samuels. She's a longtime editorial page writer for the New York Times and a great observer of the city, and by our guest analyst, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor. Dorothy Samuels, you heard Robert Reich apply the adjectives to New York, indomitable, proud, aggressive. Take us down that list. Can we still count on New York to be those things, or is it going to take a while?
No, it's interesting. All of this, all of these complicated and this week, sad events and scary events come at a time when New York is adjusting to the idea that Rudy Giuliani isn't going to be here starting in January as our mayor. And, you're talking about, this survivalist instinct. I think New Yorkers with the mayor, we have a new mayor elect.
What about that? You were expressing concern about the economy, but you've got billionaire Bloomberg there.
Well,
he's the businessman.
He could solve the problem, judging by the amount of advertising he bought during the campaign.
Just write a check, you mean?
Oh, exactly. But, it's interesting. What you're seeing is that, if 2 months ago people thought it was impossible to envision the city without Rudy Giuliani, New Yorkers, I think, have already, started moving on to a new mayor and adjusting to the fact that there is going to be a new mayor. I think they're very relieved that the mayoral campaign is over, which in some ways was a non-event, but it was hard just having the idea of a new mayor. And he looks like he's a guy who's going to be able to forge his own identity. He's already very nicely started distancing himself a little bit from Mayor Giuliani and signaling he doesn't want him to be head of the commission that will be in charge of the rebuilding of downtown, and sort of forging his own way. And he seems like he's also forging a new direction in terms of inclusiveness from the Giuliani from the Giuliani administration. I think that's also a relief for a lot of New Yorkers, which goes to another thing that I've been seeing just on the streets of New York, and I saw it, a lot during, in my neighborhood, we have this great Halloween parade, and everyone was very, very scared about what would happen in Halloween on Halloween in New York City. And yet people went out and they celebrated. And even though the parade, I think, was a little smaller, one of my colleagues said that what all the fear did is it sort of made some of these local events actually put them down to the scale they were meant to be. But it was just amazing. We had a lot of policemen out. And it was just amazing the number of my fellow New Yorkers who made a point to go by the police and to say, thank you for being here tonight.
We loved the cover of The New Yorker that showed all the kids trick-or-treating and every single one dressed as a fireman or a policeman.
Well, actually, there weren't quite as many as I thought there'd be. But there is a sense, it's interesting. I don't know what the future will be in terms of how that translates in terms of future relations in the minority community with police. But, a new twist on that is going to be the fact that our new mayor-elect is apparently planning to bring back former Mayor Dinkins' last police commissioner, which is very, very interesting.
As police commissioner. Wow, what a fascinating step. We're talking about New York and how it's coping with this most horrible of seasons. If you're in New York, how are you doing? And if you're not, what do you need New York to be for the nation now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Dr. Ian Miller. He's a clinical psychologist in New York City. He was a Red Cross volunteer at Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan. Good evening, Dr. Miller.
Good evening.
Tell us about your practice and about what you're hearing in your practice with New Yorkers who are working through everything that's going on.
Well, before I get to the practice, let me tell you about the concierge in my building.
Okay.
I think he's probably more indicative of the New York spirit. He is entirely monosyllabic. He's sad, he's mad, and he's strong. Mm. And he's got to be strong for the kids. And I think that's sort of reflective of the state of mind. Once it gets into the practice, we get a bit more intimate.
Mm-hmm. What do you take from your concierge's stance? Do you see that as a common stance around the city?
Yes, I do.
Be strong for the kids?
Well, be strong for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be strong. Mm-hmm. It also cuts against the other thing that's happening to people. Everybody, as Dorothy pointed out, is sort of triaging. They're asking each day, what is it that I have to be on the alert for? So there's a kind of heightened environmental vigilance.
Triaging their behavior during the day to reduce their risk exposure somehow?
No, their anxiety. Mm-hmm. The risk exposure can't really be reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody says, you know, every time everything stops when I hear a siren. Mm-hmm. Or a friend of mine said that he was jogging yesterday and suddenly it was quiet. There was no air traffic. And he looked up and he thought he heard warplanes. Mm-hmm. And that reminded him of the 11th. All of it's all of this stuff is physically exhausting. Mm-hmm. People feel heavy, tired, sometimes complain of tearfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a sense of heightened vulnerability, but people seem to feel like they're getting by. When Dorothy said people are still asking about anthrax, I haven't heard about anthrax actually in the last week.
It has kind of gone to sleep, hasn't it?
Right. Now, you know, it's that sort of we've absorbed it. That's sort of in post offices in New Jersey. That's not a New York thing.
Well, I've only heard on the subway. Connection with the subway.
The subway fear. Listeners, we're talking about New York and its state of mind. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Have you visited New York since September 11th? Are you a New Yorker? How are you coping with the seemingly endless series of blows? And if you're not a New Yorker, what do you need New York to be for the nation's sense of itself right now? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Reich, we're hearing here both at the level of triage for anxiety in New York, and Dorothy Samuels pointing out that there are really significant financial and economic challenges facing New York now that have fallen out of this crisis. In an economic sense, what do we need New York to be for the country?
Well, New York is the economic capital of the world. The terrorists understood that. That was, I think, very much in their minds from the beginning. But New York, even before September 11th, Tom, was in some economic difficulty. You know, New York is sort of an extreme version of the United States. When the U.S. economy is very good, as it was in the late 1990s, New York was superb, a gilded city, and it's a city that just whose property values went through the roof, beyond the roof. Nobody could afford to live in New York any longer. It's still that way. But as the economy slows, as it was slowing even before September 11th, New York was feeling the pinch, probably in a bigger way. Since September 11th, 100,000 jobs have been lost in New York City, and the equivalent amount of space, office space destroyed, more office space destroyed than in the entire city of Cincinnati, Ohio. I mean, you're talking about a big economic problem as well as a psychological problem. I'd be interested to hear from Dr. Miller to what extent there's denial going on. It sounds like there's quite a lot of denial, but you can't deny the economic realities. And unemployment is creeping upward very fast. The fiscal crisis is a very real one. Unless the Bush administration helps New York, bails it out, provides some serious funding, and New York could find itself, in much, much more serious economic difficulty than it is right now.
Dr. Miller, you're the clinical psychologist. What about it? Denial? Are people really at grips with this, or are they ducking it in the private recesses of their mind somehow?
I don't think anyone's ducking it. I think the economic difficulty is spoken of as the number two challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is talking about their portfolios and their apartments and their jobs. The death of the dot-com economy is on everybody's lips, and that's a second shot. I wanted to say that people are almost everybody is having normal stress responses, and I presume, I don't know, that in the rest of the country it's happening too.
Mm-hmm.
So So what we're seeing across the board are heightened levels of frustration and anger and sadness, a lot of irritability. There is some denial and avoidance of things you used to do and guilt. So things that you used to enjoy often don't get done.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people complain about a decreased ability to concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing a lot about self-medication, drinking, drugs, reckless behavior, and increases in relationship difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned that the holidays are coming.
Mm-hmm. And that always brings more stress.
Yes. So the thing that I think people need to think about is the recognition and the caretaking of our social and emotional competencies, given what we're up against. And it is an economic and also terrorist challenge.
We've heard, and forgive me if this is some kind of urban myth, but we've even heard that there's been more incidents of sexually transmitted disease in New York this fall.
I have heard from my internist that the VD rate is up.
And as a psychologist, can you draw any connecting line here? Is it people just turning to any port in a storm?
Well, when we're feeling vulnerable, there is a desire for physical protection.
Mm.
I think it's a very natural thing. People feel helpless.
Yeah.
What do you do?
The human New Yorker. We're talking about how New York is coping with the rain of blows that it's had this autumn. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What have you seen in New York? What do you need New York to be for the country right now? What can we do for New York? Susan from Barrington, New Hampshire is on the line. Welcome, Susan. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have business in New York on a regular basis, and I've been down about three times since September 11th, and I usually take the train in from my brother's house in Stamford, Connecticut, and then a taxi to wherever I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've noticed is normally people, like I'll chat with people in the train and then the taxi driver and maybe just people standing in line for a cup of coffee or for a bagel or something. But people, they don't seem to be coming outside of themselves. It's like they're still mourning. They kind of just... Mm. Yeah, kind of what like the doctor was saying, monosyllabic.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of, it's a pretty day, you know.
Not the same engagement for good or ill.
Yeah, it's just not the, I don't take it personally, of course, but it's not like they're rude or anything of that nature. It's just that they don't want to engage. It's almost like they don't want to risk having a relationship with you, no matter how fleeting or something, because it's, maybe they might lose you or something,
yeah.
In their mind. They're just afraid of having, friendliness towards people because, something terrible could happen to you.
Who are you going to lose next? Susan, thanks for the observation.
Yeah.
Dorothy Samuels, how about it? Do you feel that of mute button pressed?
You know, I don't know about that, but I do feel, if you take a look at the trek of New Yorkers, not just tourists, because we have many fewer of those, but New Yorkers trekking down to ground zero.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussions, if you hang around the city for any length of time, you're going to eventually be caught up in a discussion about whether folks are ready to go down
and see it for
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's sort of sacrilegious, whether it's something that's a tribute, whether it's something they need for closure, whether we should be doing, even though there's a plan for a memorial later on,
mm-hmm.
maybe we should do it now. New Yorkers, they want to do something. They are caught up in it still, whatever they're doing and whatever the other emotions are and whatever the other, needs of the day.
You make that sound almost like a pilgrimage, but does it help when New Yorkers go down
some
to
people
ground
say,
zero?
Some people have told me it's been a wonderful thing for them.
Isn't the scar just kind of a testament to New York's new vulnerability?
Well, I think for everybody it's very different. And also there are people who come back, I think, and they see it and they're angrier than ever.
Mm.
And, Ian Miller referred to that people, there is this anger, and I think that anger is something that's building, and I think that anger is something that potentially is a long-term political danger for George Bush if in a pretty short time we don't see some more substantial improvement in airport safety mm-hmm. and our own sense of physical safety and the and our sense that the government is organized and ready to protect citizens better.
Not leaving them out to dry. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're looking into the mind of New York. John is joining us from New York City. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
I've been listening to your program. I enjoyed immensely.
Thank you.
I feel there's a point missing that there's a tremendous sadness in New York City. My office is on Park Avenue and 51st Street, and right back at us, there's the fire station with all of the photographs. And I could go by there any day for the last 8 or 9 weeks and literally cry. And there's this feeling that I go through the bus terminal of the Port Authority, and there's this a massive display of every photograph of every fireman, every policeman. It would bring, blood from a stone. It's every day the New York Times has the section called A Nation Challenged, and it portrays 20 or 30 or 40 sure. of the guys who died. And it's gut-wrenching reading. It really is. I cry commuting to work. And
so do you still feel like that brassy New Yorker, John, or is there something else settling in here?
Yes, there's the brassiness there, but I think we're overlooking the fact we're all human. Beneath all this brassiness or steel determined or we will move forward, you know, the Christmas tree is going up in Rockefeller Center, mm-hmm. you know, everything is supposed to be returning to normal. But I think this normal is to a degree superficial. Deep down, we are sad. We are mourned. I think the Times on Sunday said there is a deep sadness and the anger. I have two boys who are in their mid-20s and they're so angry. They want to join the army right away to their mother's consternation. But there's anger and there's this sadness there that I haven't seen coming out in your program.
John, thanks for adding it to the mix, and thank you for your call. Dr. Ian Miller, what about it? Is it too much for the rest of the country to ask New York right now to be our cocky flag bearer, our flag bearer at all?
Well, if we're bearing a flag, it looks like Iwo Jima. We are angry, and people are angry in different ways. Uptown today, you could smell ground zero.
What do you mean exactly by that?
There's a particular odor in the air.
And, still?
Yes. And it was discernible 80 blocks away this afternoon.
It comes and goes like the smell of the sea?
Well, it's hardly the smell of the sea. It's very unpleasant, but it's there. It's all around us. How does an individual allow it to percolate? And I was speaking with somebody who lived in the red zone last night.
What's the red zone for our listeners elsewhere?
The red zone is an area around the World Trade Center that's accessible only after you had gone through police mm-hmm. and National Guard barricades. Mm-hmm. The houses were off limits for a while, mm-hmm. and then people were allowed to trickle back in. But she feels forgotten. She feels like she's being told now to enjoy life, to get back into a routine, to move on. And there's still dust all over her apartment from the World Trade Center. People take their own idiosyncratic time to begin to heal. And I think New Yorkers are feel like we're up against the challenge of being brassy. And, you know, that's why we're here.
Tough to be right now. We've got to take a quick break. Hang on, Dr. Ian Miller, Dorothy Samuels, and Robert Reich. We're talking about the brutalized psyche of New York, the anger, the sorrow. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with New Yorkers about New York tonight, and we're talking with you. How's New York doing? Are you there? What do you feel? Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Reich is with us. He describes New York as kind of our proud coxcomb for the entire nation. How is it doing right now? We're also joined by Dorothy Samuels. She's a longtime member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the recent novel Filthy Rich. And Dr. Ian Miller, he's a clinical psychologist who's been a Red Cross volunteer at Ground Zero and seeing his own patients in the months since September 11th.
Can I respond to something?
Please, Dorothy Samuels.
The last caller said, because I wouldn't want to leave it go, he suggested that we were sort of, in our comments about New York, overlooking the sadness. that we should be feeling. And the truth is, I think the sadness is the starting point for this whole discussion. That's what underlies everything else, sadness and fear and the anger that Ian Miller referred to. And then it's everybody trying to get beyond that. And that's why at the beginning of the show, I tried to suggest that when we, even the greeting, you know, as we greet each other, the normal, well, how are you today? How are you? It's always, well, okay, considering.
It's summer.
And it's almost unspoken now, the depth of sadness that I think everybody's feeling and trying to deal with.
Dorothy Simmons, I'm sorry.
Well, because we do pass, we pass these places, we pass the firehouses every day.
Let me ask you.
And there are the memorials.
You do, and we hear it, and we fully acknowledge the sadness, and we see the reasons for it played out unhappily again and again. But let me ask you this. Will we come out of this time with a different vision and understanding of New York? Is New York going to stand for something new? Will it be something new?
Well, I hope. I hope maybe New York, my fellow Americans come out with a greater appreciation of New York and what lies beneath some of the bluster and the strength and the character. And the maybe some of the contribution we make to the country and some of the sacrifice that New Yorkers have made in this struggle against terrorism. So I hope that's something that comes out of it. And I hope another part that comes out of it is that New Yorkers who may not appreciate some of the folks who do serve on the police and risk their lives, you know, fighting fires for us, that all of New Yorkers come away with a greater appreciation, and that all of us also come away with a greater appreciation of how much all of us in New York rely on each other, and that how we all share that New Yorkness that does make us, we think, pretty special.
Robert Reich, what about it? Every city stands for something. Do you see the meaning of New York changing in the mind of the nation, in the mind of New Yorkers?
Well, it's interesting, Tom. I mean, New York has always been, as we talked about earlier, to the rest of the nation, something of a paradox, something that is both exciting and extreme at the same time. And the rest of the nation empathizes with what has happened in New York. The real test, in a way, at least the test coming up, is going to be the holiday season. As both Dorothy Samuels and Ian Miller have alluded to, the holiday season is always tough psychologically for a lot of people. This time you have the overlay of not only the tragedy, but the economic difficulties. New York depends on the holiday season. And the question I have is what can New Yorkers do for each other specifically and especially over the next couple of months? What can we do, even those of us who are not New Yorkers, in looking out for each other and the psychological well-being of each other at a time where everyone is quite brittle still, not just in New York. Someone listening to the show might think that we're just limiting ourselves to New York. New York is emblematic of many places and many people, perhaps all of us in some sense.
Let's put it to Dr. Ian Miller. What's your advice? What practical steps we can take? What spiritual steps are New Yorkers taking? What can we do for each other?
Well, you know, it occurs to me that Robert's question sort of precedes the theme of the show. New York is in a stage now of relating to New York. And as Dorothy was talking, I became really mindful of it. Going down to Ground Zero, whether you go down as a volunteer or go down to look, it's become a kind of touchstone. And as Mark Twain said, describing people looking into the Grand Canyon, there are two responses. You can say, hallelujah, heaven be praised, or you can say, God damn.
Interpret those for us. Interpret the second one for us. It's just makes you feel small and insignificant?
Well, it depends. But there is a kind of angry quality of it and a powerful one that emerges rather than a kind of loving one. We're talking about people who are under tremendous stress and who are operating in moments during the day at the level of some pretty fundamental splits in the way human beings see things. Most striking to me downtown, that is below 14th Street, really, because the city is really bisected there, is a kind of polarity between good and bad.
The service people and the hole in the ground?
Yes. There is, and for the first 5 weeks or so after the attack, walking around downtown, you know, people would nod and people would say thank you for small kindnesses. I think the woman who was speaking coming down from New York as a tourist might not be sensitive to that among New Yorkers. There's a real hometown quality that's emerging. Whenever anybody talks to a group of volunteers from New York, whenever anybody trains a group of volunteers, there's always this preface where people are equated with doing the work of angels. There's a kind of quasi-religious, spiritual sense of this endurance, which is over and against the badness in the world.
And we can hope that that balance comes out right. Josh is calling from Wareham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I sort of agree with Robert Reich that New York is emblematic of the rest of the country and that we feel much of what they're going through. And I kind of wanted to repose the question of what do we need from New York and ask what does New York need or what can we do for New York as we look and watch what's going on to them. I can only offer my personal feeling of friends and family that I have there and playing a support role of sort of reconnecting with those relationships and trying to just be there as a supportive role and just helping out in whatever way you can. And in the small town USA feeling of where, you just help your neighbor out and you try to do as much as you can for them. And I wonder if that's something that New Yorkers can feel from the rest of the country?
Josh, it's a great question and the right one probably. Thanks for your call. Our time is running down, but Dorothy Samuels, you're there. You're the New Yorker. What do you need from the rest of the country?
Well, I think firstly, expressions of support really help, but I'll tell you something, at a point when, given the economy, everybody else's financial fortunes are going to be looking pretty bad across the country. Mm-hmm. I just hope across the country people remember when New York needs to go to Washington for extra help because of the calamity that befell us here, that Americans will remember that and be supportive.
Dig deep.
And urge their representatives to be supportive.
And Dr. Ian Miller, we've just got a few seconds, but what can the rest of the country do from its distance, from a remove for the city and its people?
Understand that when they get a cup of coffee and they visit New York, we might not be quite as peppy as we used to be.
And it's okay.
Yep.
Dorothy Samuels, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dorothy Samuels is a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the recent novel, Filthy Rich. And Dr. Ian Miller, thank you. Ian Miller is a clinical psychologist in New York City. Robert Reich, just a few seconds, final thought.
Well, I think that the issue here transcends not only the immediate psychological impact, Tom, and the holiday season coming up, but also there is a long-term question about the future of New York City. Its cost, its risk, were already very, very high, and many companies are considering moving out of New York permanently. This would be a disaster for New York. The demise of New York has been predicted many times before, but we need to, as Dorothy said, I think we need to support it politically. There is going to have to be some money.
The loyalty test is coming right up, maybe for us all. You can continue this conversation online at WBOR.org. Thank you, Robert Reich. Nine weeks after the World Trade Center tragedy, charities are now getting a stern reminder from the IRS. They cannot give money away to those affected by the crisis unless the family or individual can demonstrate financial distress. This is just the latest glitch for nonprofits and generous donors hoping to do good. More than $1 billion has been raised since September 11th, and donations continue to pour in. The philanthropic community has never seen anything like it, which may be part of the problem. Special coverage correspondent Jill Kaufman reports.
It all happened so quickly. The plane crashes, the grief, the fundraising. The amount of money brought in by some 200 new and established charities has impressed many in the American philanthropic community, a group of people used to handling millions, even billions of dollars a year. Unprecedented generosity should be good news after such a horrific event, but with money comes stress.
This has never happened before. As a result, there's much confusion.
Vartan Gregorian is the president of the Carnegie Corporation of New York. As he explains it, the world immediately responded after September 11th. And in the beginning, raising money and assisting victims was like coming to a potluck dinner. Individuals, corporations, and charities brought to the table what they could. 9 weeks later, though, there's a call for accountability.
Now everybody wants a menu and timetable and price tag.
And control. Bennett Weiner is the COO of the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance, the largest national charity watchdog information center in the country. With the high number of charities raising money for the same cause, he says the burden is now coordination.
I think that the main concern in regards to these efforts are going to be along the lines of, you know, how the disbursements are going to be made, and is it going to match what the donors want to happen, what they thought was going to happen, or when they made their gift.
The American Red Cross has received harsh criticism for how it plans to use about half of the $500 million collected for September 11th. Other charitable organizations have been criticized for the slow pace in which aid has been distributed. Even something as basic as the naming of a charity has raised questions. The Twin Towers Orphan Fund maintains that losing only one parent meets the legal definition of orphan. John Barashak, a co-founder of the fund, admits the common perception of an orphan is someone who has lost both parents.
It probably would have been clearer if we had called it the Twin Tower Children's Fund rather than the Twin Towers Orphan Fund. We didn't think it through at the time.
There's much that hasn't been thought through. One of the immediate reactions after a crisis is to give out money quickly. The Better Business Bureau's Bennett Weiner says for charities, that's not always the wisest.
There are both short and long-term needs that result from any crisis. And to spend it all and have nothing left are not going to address all the concerns or problems that emerge after a tragedy. So there is a feeling that haste may make waste.
Charities are able to respond quickly to crisis victims when systems are already in place. For 70 years, Save the Children has responded to unanticipated disasters worldwide. Save the Children's Rudy von Bernuth says the key issue in distributing a large amount of money or food or water is how you've anticipated what sort of emergency might occur.
The challenge, though, is in the initial stage of an emergency where you may not yet have funds and yet you have perhaps the most serious level of need. And we have created within Save the Children a designated fund that donors have explicitly contributed to with the knowledge that this was to allow us to initiate response to an emergency.
Usually, in the world of philanthropy, a cause is identified, a plan is put together, and then fundraising begins. What's happened in the September 11th relief effort is the exact opposite. The challenge has been to develop a system and respond at the same time. Since September 11th, philanthropic leaders have met on and off at the Carnegie Corporation to exchange information about where and how quickly aid is being provided. Since November 1st, the New York State Attorney General's office has created a database to better coordinate funds and help victims figure out where to go for assistance. The database is modeled on a system used after the 1995 bombing in Oklahoma City. But there are still questions about how to manage a $1.2 billion fund. If there is another tragedy like September 11th, Carnegie Corporation President Vartan Gregorian says the philanthropic community must be better prepared. What's required among foundations and charities is collaboration and efficiency. At the same time, the public needs to know more about the business of giving and understand some basic terms like
the difference between charity, philanthropy, the difference between short-term, long-term, equity, immediate need, need-based, merit-based, all of this, the public has had no understanding. And frankly, people are impatient because suffering of people magnifies their impatience.
And that, he says, is understandable. I'm Jill Kaufman.
Find out how the Arab satellite TV network Al Jazeera is reporting on the fall of Kabul. It's translated on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.